All right, good evening, everyone. Welcome back. Welcome back to a lot of folks who have been here throughout and are in week four. I know some folks were here at the beginning of the series and had to miss a few and are back this evening. And then there may even be a few folks who are jumping in tonight. Last week, we spent a lot of time with sources that imagined how you might break down the boundary between insider-outsider, between citizen and resident alien, between those with sort of like the full privileges and protections and those who don't have them, either because there is some sense of a basic obligation and responsibility to all human beings in some area, or what we really explored was the idea of when a person's status or protection or privilege is defined by behavior as opposed to being, or by their presence in some space as opposed to their status. And we in particular saw what for me was the pivotal source, which was the Talmud's question about a ger toshav vis-a-vis the question of nullifying an idol. And the question of whether this sort of Jewish-Gentile category, where Jews normally fall on one side of the divide of not being able to carry out a decommissioning of an idol, and Gentiles falling on the other side of being able to and needing to, how we think about a Gentile who acts like a Jew in the context of idolatry. And the sugya there, the Talmudic passage, featured Rav Nachman saying, it seems like it should go by behavior and not being. And we threw that out both as kind of like a paradigm for asking that kind of question, but also on some level an invitation in each case. It was pretty clear that Rav Nachman was not making a blanket statement about all things having to do with difference coming down to behavior as opposed to being, but nonetheless opening up a question of when should we ask that question and when is the answer, in fact, yeah, in this case, the issue at play or the concern at play is not really about who someone is, but what their practice is, etc. And briefly referred to that in terms of ways you can imagine that playing out, also to questions of citizens and non-citizens, you can imagine certain kinds of questions really coming down to some version of what you hear in the public discourse a lot. If someone's here and they're more or less playing by the rules, they're law-abiding, et cetera, you really shouldn't have a significant gap between citizens and non-citizens on X, Y, and Z, protection or privilege. And what we focused on last week was some of the sort of internal Jewish legal and normative language for thinking about that. This week, we're going to do really the opposite picture. So for those of you who were here last week, this will sort of complement that. For those of you who weren't here last week, you're going to hear sort of one side of the story, which is going to sound very boundary drawing and very kind of sharp and harsh in various places, which it is. And I'm not going to make apologies for that. We're going to try to understand what's being said here. But I do want to recommend to you highly to listen to week three so you get the big picture, because these are really imagined as sort of stereo sound presentations in that way. Okay, so with that, I want to jump into tonight what I've framed as the question of when is essence unavoidable? When does it kind of matter who you are in some basic way in terms of how you are treated by the group or members of the group that you are not quite defined as being a member of? And I want to start with, I think, the most basic and the most stark question, which is basically the question of self-preservation as it relates to group membership. Implicitly, the formation of any group carries with it, at least in some context, with respect to something, some privileging that the members of the group give to one another as opposed to people who are not in the group. That, I think, is unavoidable. It can be minor, it can be infrequent, but the notion that there is some hierarchy, not absolute necessarily, we'll come back to this, but relative hierarchy that is established is, I think, almost self-evident when you are defining a group in some way. And often, not always, because other groups are not organized in this way, but many groups have as one of their basic, even most primal elements, that they look out for one another in some kind of special way in the otherwise undifferentiated and perhaps even threatening mass of humanity. I was thinking about this a lot in this week, kind of gearing up for this. And as is my practice, was talking my kid's ear off about it. And, you know, just point blank, like asking my 12-year-old, okay, you gotta save your brother or your brother's friend. What are you gonna do? Okay, this way is actually interesting, okay? He was like, of course, my brother. I was like, why? So he said, well, he's my brother, and so I love him. I think at one point he might have said, I'm supposed to love him. So that's why. And I pushed him. I was like, well, really? Okay, so what if it was your brother or, you know, ex-kid who's your best friend from school? If we're talking love or how much you get along. And at that point, he was like, well, to be honest, I don't want to answer that question. And you could see him grappling in some basic way of feeling like, I don't even know if I want to say moral obligation, but there was some sort of basic primal obligation he knew he had to his brother. But once he started to engage in some sort of category of affect and care and consideration and support and this and that, that started to blur. And then, right, I went right to it and I was like, okay, let's say two random people you don't know at all, one of them is Jewish and one of them is not. To which his answer was, I know the answer is the Jew, but I really hate that answer. Okay? Now, that I think was as good a vignette. You could all generate this with all the people in your life. As good a vignette of grappling with the notion, this sort of unavoidable category, and I don't even think he wanted to avoid it, of there being some people who make claims on us that are different from other people. This was not an ontological test for him. I think, in other words, when he was saying, I don't like the answer, I would save the Jew as opposed to someone else, what he's saying there is, I totally reject the notion, putting a little bit of words into a 12-year-old's mouth, but I know him pretty well. I totally reject the notion that there is an ontological difference of worth between these two people. But I do sort of feel forced to acknowledge that, like, I'm in this group with this person a little more than this other person, at least in the thought experiment of I have no relationship with either of them. Okay? When we talked about it further and I was trying to drill down, like, why does the brother have a privileged space? I said to him, look, I think there's a lot of ways we could talk about it, but it seems to me unavoidable that one of the reasons, like, we live together in this house, and one of the ways that, like, as a society, we structure this is we basically have an unspoken agreement that, like, we are going to particularly look out for one another. Like, that's certainly true vis-a-vis me taking care of you. And if you think about, like, me getting older and being vulnerable, you taking care of me. But also, in terms of siblings, there's some sort of rock bottom element of that. The text we're going to look at now, I think, draw that out in sort of uncomfortable but perhaps unavoidable ways that we can argue over with respect to what I would say is sort of the effort to control for the variable of behavior. In other words, just as I'm controlling, I'm like, no, pretend you don't know them. There's nothing there about sort of affinity for the person. And you strip something down to group membership in some way. Does that affect the conversation? All right, now this grows out of a passage in the Sifra, which we've seen a number of times. We're here on page 1. Growing out of verses we'll come back to a little later tonight, but I just want to read you again from Vayikra Kafhei. This is the verse which you will recall is the main anchor for all impulses towards equality and care for the Ger Toshav as a member sort of Israelite society that needs to be sustained and enabled to thrive, et cetera, et cetera. We're here, the verses that are referred to here are v'chiyamuch achicha umata yado imach, when your brother goes low and his hand slips with you, v'hechezakta bo ger v'toshav v'chayimach, in the rabbinic reading you should strengthen him, and as it's read in rabbinic sources we'll see in a second, strengthen him, and also a ger and a toshav, you should also strengthen them, v'chayimach, and they, so that person can live with you. Al tikach meito neshech v'tarbit, do not take interest from them, v'yareta me'elohecha, have reverence and fear for your God, v'chei achicha imach, and your brother should live with you. Okay? An overarching statement of, these are other people you're responsible to. They both include your brother, that's your fellow Israelite, but also the ger and the toshav, and all of them have this imperative of v'chai imach, and they should live with you. Okay. In the Sifra here, we've got the opening verse. When your brother falls low, his hand slips with you, don't allow him to go down. How do we know even if you supported him several times, you should support him again and give him strength, echazaktabo, and going on, ger in the verse refers to the ger tzedek, the convert, in keeping with that interpretational move we've seen throughout. Toshav, ze ger ochel nevelot. The toshav refers to the ger, but who is not the convert, but the one who is allowed to eat non-kosher meat, this character of the ger toshav. V'chayimach, chayecha kodmim lechayav. He shall live with you. Your life takes precedence over his life. Okay, what's the read here? V'chay, he should live, imach, but with you, which means you don't put yourself at risk, you don't privilege him, you don't have an obligation to v'chai him independent, it's v'chai imach, you have to take care of yourself, and with your additional bandwidth, you have to take care of him. So far from this sifra, that seems like it just would apply to all of the characters we've been talking about, a Jew, a ger tzedek, a convert, a ger toshav, someone who is this resident alien, and all of them, yes, you have to take care of them, but none of that means that you prefer them to yourself.
So what does that ayecha could mean with ayav?
It would mean if you have a choice on some level of preserving yourself, but it is at the cost of preserving his life, you are not obligated to somehow favor or privilege him over yourself. It's a kind of legitimation of some baseline self-interest. Right? In other words, when it comes down to altruistically giving up your life for someone else or preserving your life, I'm not getting into a whole discussion of martyrdom and things on someone compelling you. We'll see now in a second the famous case where this is discussed. There's only enough resources to sustain one of you. You come first, okay? Now that seems to just be global here, but now let's look what happens. A couple passages later in the Sifra, v'chei achicha imach. The first time this appears, it's v'chai imach, and then it's v'chei achicha imach in the verses that I mentioned to you. And so in the second verse, brother appears. On this, we get the following tradition, which some of you may also know from its appearance in the Talmud. Zo darash ben Peturi. This was a tradition expounded by ben Peturi. If two people were walking in the desert, and one of them has one container of water, such that if one of them drinks it, he will get back to the yeshuv, to civilization, and survive. But if both of them drink it, they will both die. Darash ben Petire, yishtushtehem v'yamutu. Ben Petire says, you have to actually split the water and both die. Okay? And whether anyone's going to listen to this is another story, but as a moral principle, says Ben Petiri, you have no right, just because you have possession of the water, to privilege your own survival over someone else's. And therefore, and neither does the other person have the right to accept the water, even if you generously offer it to them. And therefore, you basically have no choice but to both try to survive as best you can while divvying up everything equally. And what's the drasha here? V'chei achicha imach. Your brother's life is to be preserved with you. And Petiri reads this differently, which is with you just like yours. There's no basis for distinguishing between you and your brother, so you'll both have to die. Amar lo Rabbi Akiva, v'chei achicha imach, chayecha kodmin l'chayei chavercha. He reads chei achicha imach the way you had to read it when we encountered this phrase in the first instance. No, we'll live with you. You are the fixed point. To the extent there's added resources, you sustain someone else, but you don't make yourself vulnerable. Okay, now, the question is, what do we do with the imbalance here in the Sifra? First of all, why does Chayecha Kodmim LeChayav appear twice? And second of all, why doesn't the Ben Peturei tradition appear in the first paragraph as well? Why do we only get that in the second one? So, if you turn the page, one of the readings of this is by the Malbim on the Sifra, who says, therefore the Sifra explained the phrase, v'chayimach, and he is to live beside you, as meaning, your life takes precedence over his life. But on v'chayachichayimach, so that your brother may live beside you, there it cites the exposition of Ben Peturei, because that, ze rak b'Yisrael, that only applies to a Jew. In the case of a ger toshav, Ben Peturei would agree with Rabbi Akiva that one's own life takes precedence. In other words, how does the Malbim read the Sifra? Paragraph 1 is actually about the ger toshav, and there everyone agrees that the group member is going to privilege himself over someone who is outside of the group. But in the second paragraph, which is v'chei achicha imach, it is about your brother, then at least Ben Peturei thinks there's a kind of mutual annihilation of rights here, of self-preservation, and the ship just has to go down. Rabbi Akiva takes the position, no, in that case too, you have the right to preserve yourself. Owing allegiance to a member of the group doesn't mean you have to yourself give up your life. But the difference here is that the first case is not parallel to the second case. All right. Now, there's other readers of the Sifra who reject this. I think the Gra erases the line Chayecha Kodmin LeChayav in the first paragraph, and there are ways of reading it as already just assuming Rabbi Akiva's position up there, and maybe it's a later gloss coming in. Now that we know we follow Rabbi Akiva, I'm going to apply it to that case too. There are ways out of the question of whether the Sifra means this, but the Malbim's reading of the Sifra, I think, is a kind of unavoidable dynamic that is always going to exist whenever any group is defined. When you get down to it, right, at the end of the day, the United States government is going to privilege the lives of American citizens abroad amidst the group of other people who might be there, who it might also want to intervene for and take care of. To say nothing of ways in which that might happen less explicitly but implicitly in a domestic scene as well, though this is where I think we get to the question of what are the limits of that principle. Here we're actually talking about someone dying. Obviously, the whole notion of l'hachayoto and the notion of the ger toshav being protected writ large is to combat this instinct, is to say, I know you have a temptation to say, well, that person's not in my group, I don't need to take care of them. Yes, you do need to take care of them, but I want us to just sort of begin the evening by recognizing that I think it's hard to imagine that some Malbim-like reading of the Sifra doesn't exist somewhere in the air, at least in some circumstances that are dire when you are dealing with definitions of groups. And then I think the kind of explosive question is, once that exists at all, does it infect the rest of the discourse? Right? Someone can read a Malbim on a Sifra like this and basically say, yes, this is why at the end of the day I reject any grouping of humanity into subgroups, because I'm unwilling to have any residue of this. To which someone else might respond in any number of ways, but they might respond, well, that's crazy. Like, that's the way humanity works. It divides into subgroups. And also, sometimes it needs to. And there are people who need each other, and they need to protect each other. And that's just the cost of what it is. All right, but this, I don't want to run away from this dynamic as one way in which I think we should not be surprised. The boundary between in and out will rarely be completely eviscerated unless we are actually just eliminating the boundary. Now, part of what it is, we're not going to spend too much time on this here. I think for most people, the line here is, does the category feel like it has enough sense, weight, dignity, meaning to justify some kind of privileging? Most of us feel that completely instinctively with respect to parents and children. Right? We do not look at, not only do we not look at a parent who would prefer, who would privilege saving their child over another kid as not being a moral monster, we would probably be mostly horrified by a parent who would be like, well, I guess I got to flip a coin. It's either my kid or his playmate, right? That because something would unnerve us about what kind of society is it going to be where parents don't have that particular affinity. I think we also would be equally kind of horrified by a grouping of people with blonde hair where that was a basis for determining who gets the canteen or not. But that would ultimately be a factor of us feeling that the tie and the bond between parent and child feels not just real but important, and the bond between people who have blonde hair seems trivial or maybe even problematic, and therefore we don't even want that to be a factor at all. And that's where always the question of Jewish versus Gentile or other groupings in a way are going to come down to not how do we think we should police group boundaries, but how important do we think the group is and for what purpose. Okay, that's our opening bit. Thoughts and questions on that?
I'm curious, so like these scenarios seem to depend on there being either limited resources or external danger.
Mm-hmm.
And does the same logic of in-group, out-group, and how you treat people hold in cases of like excess?
Right, so I think a lot of what we saw last week, and again, with all the caveats of the scaling down of Ger Toshav in the rabbinic record from the much more robust biblical category, this mitzvah of lahachayoto, to support those, don't lend on interest, etc., right? The Bible on some level is, I don't know if I'd say excess, but sufficient plenty that you basically can give an interest-free loan. Right? And we're going to get to that, whether the interest-free loan is going to apply to the Ger Toshav. But the basic notion of lahachayoto, that is the imperative of saying, no, no, when there's enough resources to go around, you can't treat at least some subset of people outside the group any differently than the people in the group. But the question here, of course, that's where these thought experiments are always go, is, okay, but what if it is a choice? But when there's not a choice, there'll be a general imperative. Yeah.
What's the extent of which you have to go to like have precedence over your own life? Like if you have the water and he doesn't, like are you supposed to like actively make sure that he can't get it?
In terms of Rabbi Akiva, like his view, or according to the Malbim on the first piece, no, I think it's the idea. In other words, if he's holding the water, does this text license you to steal it from him? That's an interesting question. Meaning it's not really interesting for me, but I mean, it seems obvious to me, I don't think you can do that, but does the Sifra think you can do that? I'm not sure that's clear. I think the Sifra here, like particularly the way it's phrased of biyad echad kiton shalmayim, right? One of them is holding it. And the text is saying, do you have to let the other guy drink or not? That's the scenario. You're already taking us to another place of, does the equality also entitle me to grab it from them and force them to die if they're not playing by the ring, etc. Okay. Any other point or comment on this? Okay. Let's move on to another piece, which I think is another sort of ground rule element here, which I think is also very hard to avoid. What I've titled here, power. And this I want to just play out with a text that will be surprising to some of you, which doesn't have to do with the Ger Toshav at all, though it certainly includes the Ger Toshav because it even makes a claim about the Ger Tzedek, the convert to Judaism. This is a text that springs from Dvarim's instructions. Som tasim alecha melech, you want a king? You can appoint yourself a king. Understood even later in the rabbinic tradition as there should be a king in the ideal in the ideal plan, or there should be some kind of, you know, central Israelite government, whom God will choose, mikerev achecha tasim alecha melech, but the king has to be from your own, from your brethren. Lo tuchal latet alecha ish nochri asher lo achichahu. You cannot put someone who is a foreigner above you as a king who is not your brother. All right? Now, ish nochri, here we talked about the nochri, this almost seems like it's like a mercenary king, right? It would be like, why might you do this? You would hire someone, basically, from another nation, or that you think they're a great commander, soldier, leader, and they're going to be the person who's going to lead you to deliverance. You're not allowed to do that. But this verse, in all kinds of ways, becomes the archetype for thinking about what are the boundaries of leadership of the Jewish community more broadly. And we get this kind of shocking statement of Rava. The statement is an inclusive statement, but with an assumption of exclusion behind it. Ger danet chavero dvar Torah. A convert to Judaism can serve as a judge for another convert, according to the laws of the Torah. As it says, Som tasim alecha melech, asher yivchar Hashem Elokecha bo mikerev achecha tasim alecha melech, placing over you a king, over you we require the leader to be from your brethren, but over a convert can serve as the judge. All right, now, on its own terms, just to understand this text on its own terms, but then I want to get to sort of its application, this is essentially saying when we see the word achicha, your brother, that is an ethnic origin term. If someone converts into Judaism, they become a Jew, but according to this, they don't fall under the category of achicha in the sense in which it's used here. And to the extent that this verse is trying to sort out who is eligible for the monarchy or for its kind of derivatives, judges sitting on panels, etc., etc., that is going to apply only to those who in some way, and then there'll be all kinds of debates around this, can go back, let's say, at least one generation to a Jewish parent. That is to say, it's going to apply to someone born as a Jew. All right. Now, Rava here is subject to a lot of interesting debates. Some people try to take this at its plain sense and basically say, yeah, from here you learn that, like, converts are not allowed to serve on a Beit Din, on a Jewish court. You have other sources that try to minimize and say, no, this is only about capital crimes, dinei nefashot, which is convenient for them because those don't really exist at any real time in Jewish live rabbinic history. So it's a way of sort of marginalizing this and saying, no, when you're talking about civil cases, that's no problem, that doesn't matter. But what I want you to understand is, like, a clear extrapolation from this is, of course there is no way that a ger toshav can serve as a judge. Okay? In other words, when we're talking about who can wield power, the space where we're playing out the gray area is, can the person who is a member of the covenant, has accepted all the mitzvot upon themselves, but was not born with those obligations, step into that position of power? But it is obvious that, it is obvious that the biblical directive, lo tuchal lasim alecha ish nochri, you cannot have an outsider serve as a king, will mean that you cannot have someone who is not a part of that group being in charge in some way that exerts authority, right? So again, you can define the group as you want, right? You want to define a Jewish polity as being a Jewish ethno-national state. You cannot have an Arab as a judge according to a model like this. You want to define a state as being a state of all of its citizens for purposes of, for jurisprudential reasons. Well, then, yeah, a non-citizen will not be able to serve in that role. You can define whatever the group is, but this text is also, I think, reminding us something, which is somewhere there's going to exist a line of power. There's going to exist a line. Not having someone in the group inevitably means you do not put your fate fully in that person's hands. in the same way you put your fate in the hands of others in the group. And again, scope, place, where it applies, that's going to be the argument in the details. But the principle I want to suggest is not going to easily go away. Okay, anything on that, just sort of clarifying or understanding? It's less dramatic than dying in the first case, but it's actually kind of the same ilk of sort of self-preservation leading to self-determination. Yeah.
If nobody, as we understand as a foreign person who's not part of the group, why do we need that qualification of Asher?
Yeah, like you're just asking, even in terms of the biblical verse, isn't there like a redundancy there? Asher lo achichahu. I'm not remembering now what the Sifrei or the other Midrashic sources do with it and if they make something of it. That I have to check for you. You're right that that is somewhat verbose in terms of at least how the Midrashim would read this. I don't remember offhand. All right, but the emphasis is you can't have an outsider. And maybe it says it with a lot of words, but the conclusion is clear. Okay? Yeah, Dina.
Is it saying that halacha is talking to Jews who are born Jews only?
What do you mean halacha is talking
halacha,
to?
The word halacha.
Oh, Alecha, yeah.
So, and does that apply to other places where the Torah says you?
Yeah, well, we've seen this, so on some level it is...
Yeah, it's fine, but forget...
Yeah, well, look, it's an extension of, as you may recall, we sort of dealt with this a little bit in week two, which is to say, the rabbinic move, I'm talking in very crass, broad terms here, there's a lot more nuance, right? But the rabbinic move on some level is to invent the convert, okay? Or to insert the notion that someone can become the Israelite. And the way on some level it reads that into the Torah is that the word ger is sort of the placeholder for that. But then what you have then created is the notion that, oh, the Torah itself doesn't use the word Yisrael when it wants to talk about a convert. So you've sort of bought the biblical grounding of the concept, but reified the distinction between the convert and the born Israelite, at least as far as the verse flows. And that opens you up to second person endings potentially following that as well when you're dealing with a verse that talks about people who are in or people who are out. I don't think that's the only way they could have read this verse.
This verse doesn't talk about care, right?
No.
It's easy to say you can't have an Okri judging a capital case about a Jew.
That's right. And this is why I don't mean to suggest here this is the only way to read that verse in the Torah. And that you couldn't reach a conclusion. No, Alecha is just anyone who's in. Like, maybe they were born in, maybe they came in. That doesn't matter. At least this tradition, here's where I think we want to be careful. It might be that this tradition reflects a thoroughgoing approach of assuming, no, there's two kinds of people who are in, and when the Torah says you, right, it is only referring to those who were born that way. It is possible it is specific to Malchut. Okay? In other words, that they are reading in some specific fear around leadership and power that is more analogous to the ban on a naturalized citizen in the United States becoming the president, which is not really reflective of the Constitution's thoroughgoing distinction between people who are naturalized and born, but is resident in who gets to occupy that office. Yeah, you wanted to add?
No, I just think, I mean, it does say the character. You don't need the word Alecha. Like, you can focus on the character of Pinchas if that's what you wanted to do. It does focus on it also, but it seems to hinge on, I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's because when it says, right, it's because lo tuchal atet alecha is linked specifically to the ish nochri, I think. There's some things here in terms of the midrashic reading of this text that we're seeing here we could, you know, play out more deeply. I want us just to hold on to this as another category of power as something where those lines get drawn. And I think we see that all the time, right? That's where anxieties will go up higher around questions of non-citizens or people at the boundaries, etc. Are they going to actually have, you know, the fate of some self-defined group merged with theirs or handed over to them? That's another piece here. Okay, let's move forward. See a few other things, and then I want to see two other things quickly, and then spend a little more time in depth on on another unit here that I think will be helpful for unpacking this. So kind of briefly on 3 and 4 here, what you see, I think, is another area that's a little gray. I'm interested to hear folks' thoughts. I think this is both a kind of distinction on the one hand can be sort of easy to justify. On the other hand, you can imagine being essentially a slippery slope to a much more thoroughgoing difference of bias and discrimination. And this is the idea of, it's one thing to say the in-group is protected in a way that the out-group is not. That's a kind of stark difference. It's another thing potentially to say, you're a member, you get a 10% discount. Okay, right? Like that, we don't generally think of those kinds of distinctions as being as offensive, particularly if it's possible to become a member. Okay? But that then, once there's sort of some transparent process and there's some way of doing that, okay, then yes, one of the things of being in the group might be you will be privileged as opposed to the people outside of the group. And the question is how we think about that in light of various, I would say, mitzvot in the Torah that are ultimately about that. When the Torah says, don't charge interest to your brother, lo tashich le'achicha, but says, lanuchri tashich ula'achicha lo tashich, charge interest from the foreigner, but don't charge interest from your brother, we can read that initially as being, why don't you nail him with that penalty of interest? But, you know, don't do that predatory practice to, the people you're looking out for their interest. Or you can read it as, with the Nohri, you can do what every normal person does, which is you charge interest, right? I don't know what the last time is anyone in this room got an interest-free loan from a bank. Like, I'd love to hear about it. Or you had a credit card that had zero interest, you know, ad infinitum. The normal way credit works is that people charge on interest. And the Torah is going out of its way to saying, one of the ways you're going to demonstrate your particular kind of looking out for your brother, you're going to forego this right that you would otherwise normally have in the marketplace. Okay? That seems to have been the way that, right, it's not clear. Again, from Dvarim, we could say, who's included in Achicha? Is the Ger Toshavin? Is the Ger in? How do we think about that? But the way rabbinic sources pretty clearly seem to have thought of this, if you jump down to the Mishnah and Bava Metzia, is Lovin Mehen, and this is talking about Goyim, so we're on page 3 here in the middle. You borrow money from Gentiles, and you lend money to them on interest, V'chein beger Toshav. Okay? Going back to, if you remember, the Meiri from last week. This is a rejection of any reading where you might say, well, the reason you charge Gentiles interest is because they would screw you over, so you're allowed to screw them over. Right? They would not respect your rights, so if you can get some interest out of them, do it. No, because if that were the case, then the Ger Toshav should be treated differently than the Ger Toshav who, in at least the main definitions, is a sort of decent person who is kind of abiding by the rules, etc., should not be in that category. The Ger Toshav is. This fundamentally understands this as sort of like a perk that is extended to someone who can be called Yisrael and not to anyone who's outside of that group. The Gemara there tries to sort of anchor this in the Psukim, because you'll remember the verses that I just read a couple minutes ago at the beginning say, Vehechazakta bo, strengthen him, ger, v'toshav, v'chai imach, strengthen your brother, and the ger, and the toshav, al tikach meito, neshech v'tarbit, don't take interest from him. Which when you're reading the verses seems like it means you can't take interest from anyone you're supposed to sustain, which would include the ger toshav character. In the Gemara there, you can look at it inside, they'll say, no, it doesn't say al tikach me'itam neshech v'tarbit. It's not in the plural. Don't take from them all the characters I just mentioned, but al tikach me'ito, don't take from him, b'Yisrael akatuv medaber. The verse is only talking about a Jew. Only a Jew gets that sort of privilege, that perk, that discount, as it were. Okay? This is another thing. I think this is like a question, and You can see I also brought you, it's the same thing with the release of the sabbatical year debts, the idea of hashmatat ksafim, someone owes you money. The normal thing you do when someone owes you money is collect the debt, but the Torah says every 7 years forgive it, and the rabbinic tradition says, yeah, you forgive it, but only lire'ehu, only for someone who is close into you, and that excludes the ger toshav. They operate by the normal rules. We saw this in week one and week two also around slavery. You're not supposed to buy an Israelite to serve in perpetual servitude. You are allowed to buy a ger toshav, but it's also clear the ger toshav might have bought you, okay? So this is another line. I'm curious to sort of hear thoughts about this that I think exists. And to me, what's sort of tricky about this line is, as I said, you can read it in two different ways, right? On the one hand, it's just, look, I'm not giving you the discount. And particularly if you assume, well, the Ger Toshav could decide to convert and become Jewish and get the discount, as it were, then, okay, this is not actually a meaningful boundary in some way. But in another way, whenever we set up kind of hierarchical privileges in that way, I think we're going to sort of come back to the same question of, is it a meaningful difference? In other words, it's one that, great, I became a member of the children's place, consumer, you know, the common, you can see where I was this afternoon, you know, the frequent buyers program. I actually didn't, I resisted. And okay, I'll, you know, give them my email address and I'll get 10% off. That feels like it's sort of reasonable. And it's not like, oh, you have blonde hair and you paid me $5, now you're allowed to get into medical school, right? There's always gonna be, I think, that question of, is there some proportion here? But that, I think, is the interesting thing with this line. These lines are also going to exist. How we think about them is probably highly variable. Yeah.
Yeah, I think one of the interesting things is sort of is the way that the Ger Toshav is this term that we apply in to the Israelites, right? And then it gets carried over into this sort of new rabbinic Judaism. So it's the sort of carryovers from this time when it's a nation to this time when, like, from Israelite to Jew. So you sort of, and I guess I sort of see this as one of these sort of strange, like, crossover things. It's like, well, when you're determining the economic policy, it might make sense that the people who are domestic versus, you know, foreigners, but then when you're sort of spread out around the world, it, or when you're in religion living within a, you know, broader nation, right? So there's something about the nation that's interesting and gets conflated and deflated. And
yeah, well, in some ways, so I might take what you're saying and actually flip it in a slightly different way. And this is where I think applying some of this discourse to governments is problematic. Because I could say to you, this kind of discounted membership on, you know, interest-free loans, etc., is somewhere between praiseworthy to fine to innocuous when you're dealing with a people who are scattered, not really wielding power over people's lives. And it's like you have some kind of like Landsman union of people who look out for each other. And okay, other people can look out for each other too, but this is the way we're doing it. And to say this person's not in the group, I don't extend this to them, is one thing. To say I can be a sovereign nation where all these people live on the land in the same way, but I'm now going to privilege one group over the other, is a different kettle of fish. Now, to the extent you make it easy to naturalize, that might change things dramatically. But to the extent it is not easy to naturalize, and then having certain benefits is conditioned on that, but you can't reasonably cross that border, then it starts to become something very different. Now, I think what you're pointing to, which is reminding us, is before we get to the rabbinic revolution, arguably the plain sense of the Torah is that the ger, who is not a convert, but is the outsider person who lives on the land, precisely for that reason, has to be broadly protected and treated as an equal.
Right. So one of the things I'm curious about is how much are they doing, like with the temple, they continue to talk about it, but sort of make-believe. So how much, talking about Ger Toshav and some of these
That's
issues,
right.
is it make-believe?
So, right. So I, great. So I mentioned this in the first part of this series, which is, there is a good bit of it which you know, we could describe as make-believe. I might say it's make-believe in the sense of it is a construct for thinking something through that is not fully relevant or realized and yet feels important to think through, but in a context that doesn't have all the consequences that this potentially has today. And I think one of the biggest challenges, which I'll say I'm leaving open here, like it's something I sort of struggle with thinking through this, is, yeah, there's a real question on some level, so much of religious Zionist halakha has staked its essence on answering this question in the affirmative. Is it possible for rabbinic halakha to own all of the moral and political dimensions of modern statecraft and actually use its discourse developed in a fundamental state of powerlessness, statelessness in a context of actual Jewish power in the state of Israel, or as a useful model for thinking about it in the United States vis-a-vis citizens and not? I don't know, right? Like, I want the answer to be yes on some fundamental level. I'm committed to the answer being yes in terms of a sort of a discourse, but you have to be kind of broad thinking and creative and be looking for sort of the seeds of ideas that have not been fully developed that you can then play out as a new kind of mantra that you're applying to a new situation. But it's complex, and thank you for reminding us of that.
Just continue this line of thought.
Yeah.
I'd like to protect the state of Israel because in the Supreme Court, they had a Christian Supreme Judge.
That's right.
Which actually just finished his 20 years in the Supreme Court.
That's right. No, that's right. And I think you see, I think in Israel, you see a lot of anxiety, and I would say even inconsistency around this. I don't even mean that as a critique, though it could also be a critique. You obviously have had, you have had Arab judges on the Supreme Court. You mentioned correctly that he is a Christian, and the ways in which various subgroups of Arabs are related to differently by the Jewish majority in terms of whether they are a fifth column or not a fifth column. And then there's, of course, the fact that it is both true that there is significant Arab representation in the Knesset, and they have never been in a government, right, holding a ministerial post. That is a playing out in ways I'm sure we have lots of different feelings about in this room. That's a playing out of these questions, right? The resistance to bringing in Arab ministers to the government is some version of lo tuchal asim alecha ish nochri. Right, that is playing out the notion of, well, you can't put your life or your fate in the hands. And then, of course, even when they were not in the government in a ministerial post, one of the main charges against Oslo was it didn't have a Jewish majority that voted for it in the Knesset. That was another way of playing this out. If we're not just talking about passing a budget, but we're talking about are people's lives at stake, is the group sort of future and destiny being determined, who sits in that position of power, right? And that, what I'm trying to sort of call our attention to is, you could have very different opinions as to how that should play out in this issue with this group or that group. You shouldn't be surprised or shocked that that's going to come up, because on some level, it is intrinsic to the notion of having the group in the first place. Because otherwise, what does it mean that some people are in that boundary and some people are out? Okay. One more short thing here before we get to the more extended example. Another example of this, which we saw glancingly last time, which also I think shouldn't surprise us, is resistance to blurring the group boundary when it feels like that will undermine the identity of the group itself. Okay? So, right, to go to the context of immigration for a minute, right? The boogeyman of lenient immigration policies is amnesty, if not open borders, right? When people start talking about that, what do you want? You want open borders? Part of what they're saying is if you don't actually, in some meaningful sense, define who's in the country or who's out, isn't the end game of that there's not a border, there's not a citizen, There's no way of defining actually who's voting, who's in, et cetera, et cetera. Now, there may well be all kinds of ways one can define that, not based on boundary or based on any number of things. And obviously, depending on how robust a vision you have of naturalization and immigration and whether that's good, you're going to come to different procedural conclusions. But there is also, unsurprisingly, going to be an anxiety around issues where the very fabric of the group is being questioned. And here, too, this is something I hope I'll deal with in greater length in a separate series in the spring, but it is interesting to look at the very little amount of sources that we have about imagining something like the question of intermarriage and a ger toshav. Okay, the notion of someone who you cannot really distinguish yourself from them based on baseline behaviors of decency, but you're Jewish and they're not. Okay, so there's not some sort of second order boogeyman of, well, but if you marry that person, they're going to lead you to become an idolater or whatever it is. But there is a kind of, there's some meaning apparently, like you're Jewish, they're not. What does it mean to think about that? And this we saw just in passing, I kind of passed over this line. This is what I want to look at now on the bottom of four. In Masechet Gerim, that source that talks at length about all the ways in which you got to treat the ger toshav mostly equivalent to the Jew, okay? This text actually disagreeing with the Mishnah actually says you can't lend to him on interest and says things like, got to put him in a good neighborhood, got to have a place, got to live in a place where he can make a good living. In the middle of that sticks the line, Ein masi'in lo velo nosin mimenu nashim, on five, one does not marry off Jewish women to him, nor does one marry women from him. All right, we're imagining a male figure of the ger toshav, and the root, the verb lehasi is someone marrying off to that person. And I think it's sort of amazing, right, to watch, just look at the line, like, you can't do that. One may not lend or borrow from him on interest. I mean, it's almost like the author of this text is emphasizing, this is not about I'm trying to turn on this person and take advantage of them at every moment. I'm just trying to say, yes, you got to watch out, secure all their rights, but they're still different, and that difference has to be maintained. All right? Now, you can question this text. Does every text think about it this way? Could you imagine ways of playing out the status of the ger toshav in other ways? That would be a shiur on that topic. But here I'm just surfacing, this is another kind of dynamic that happens. And if you look, I think this is interesting, Rav Ovadia Yosef, in a tshuva that's mostly about Bishulei Goyim, about this interesting, unusual category of the question of consuming food that was cooked by a Gentile, which is debated as to what exactly is the origin of that. It's already a thing that appears in the Talmud, but there's some discussion over what is the concern that's playing out there. One of the questions that came up over time was, is this just a proxy for worrying about idolatry? In other words, is the reason I'm not allowed to eat this person's food because they're an idolater? And Rav Ovadia cites an interesting view. He says, I saw in the name of Rav Rafael Berdugo, this is on the bottom of page 5, that it seems that it should be permitted to eat from the cooked foods and bread of the Gentiles in our lands, since they are Muslims who do not worship idols. Right? Trying again, this is like what we did last week, trying to break down, oh, is this a Jew-Gentile law, or is this a, you know, monotheist idolater law? And him suggesting, it seems to me this is an idolatry law, and so therefore it shouldn't apply to the Muslims. But then he says, but from the words of all the legal authorities, all the poskim, it seems there's no difference between idol worshippers and Muslims. In other words, he can't find in any of the legal record anyone who ever suggested that distinction. He also notes that's the common practice. What everyone was doing, to the extent they were observing these rules, was to say it was a Jew-Gentile law. And then he says, nonetheless, whenever we find a lenient position on these matters, even if the position is disputed, we should follow it in these lands. So it seems to me. This is an interesting kind of technique you'll sometimes see a posek do, which is to say, look, I think the position should be lenient here. I can't really find anyone to like be precedent for me, so therefore I will go through the halachic record and cherry pick every lenient position on this topic and say, well, when it's Muslims, clearly the strict people would concede to the lenient person that it's okay, and that way, you know, sort of whittle it away. This is what Rav Berdugo says. But then Rav Ovadia answers, that doesn't make any sense. There's nothing compelling about that argument, because the reason for forbidding food cooked by Gentiles is on account of the fear of intermarriage or the possibility of eating non-kosher food. And both of those concerns apply to Muslims who are not idolaters. Now, what Rav Ovadia here is assuming is, of course, that the ban on intermarriage itself is not a derivative concern of idolatry. But that's just an illustration of what I think is often going to be the case, which is the anxiety around group, in-group, out-group distinctions will, for many people, intuitively rise high when it comes to a place of dissolving the meaning of the group. There is a way in which the Bible, I think, had an easier time with this, in that the land and the Israelite monarch kind of stably defines, at least in the imagination, oh, this is a Jewish space granted to the Jewish people being run and ruled by a Jew. Then we can take responsibility for everyone who's here. In a way that already in the rabbinic discourse, without that framing, I think some of the question of, but wait a minute, I need to know who's in the group or not, may be clearer. And let's remember, even in the Bible, right, the ger is still different from the Israel. And as we saw in week one, there's all kinds of behavioral and other things that remain, keep that distinction clear. But marriage is one area where I think we start to see, what does it mean like for populations to merge? And that's another area where this kind of anxiety is gonna come up. And some degree of here, I'm not sure I would call it privileging. This is more about separation. Okay, good. Any comment or question on that before now we go to our main example that we're going to spend the rest of our time on? Yeah.
So I wanted to go back to some of the examples, both from interest and also from like the Shofet situation.
Yep.
So it seems like you're creating a third culture. Like your Toshav is neither Jew nor no free.
Mm-hmm.
And in some ways it seems like they're going to have loyalty to one another because they're, you know, giving each other loans without interest, potentially, and they're also judging each other. So what does that do towards the acceptance of Ger Toshav? Actually, they're no longer interested in, you know, prioritizing their relationship to you, the Jew. They're more interested in prioritizing their relationships to their other, neither here nor there, people. That's my first question. My second question is, in the examples that you're giving about, you know, being part of a buyer's club that gives you a discount, The assumption that your creditor is making, or the assumption that the children's place, whatever, is making, is that by giving you this discount, you're going to go buy more, and they're mm-hmm. actually going to make up the money that they're discounting you
right.
By whatever means. And what is it exactly that Jews are assuming they're getting from other Jews and not from Ger Toshav? And if there's also this third culture situation, is the Ger Toshav getting that same thing
mm-hmm.
from other people?
Right. So on the second point, yes, it's an important distinction. I think to the extent, I don't know if we can completely monetize this, but you are getting stronger bonds of fraternity and mutual care. That is to say, it's the same thing tzedakah gives, because that's really what an interest-free loan is, right? It's a form of tzedakah. It is certainly what the release of sabbatical year debt release is about. It's a kind of compelled, cyclical, built-in charity, which I would say, yeah, the point of charity beyond a sort of, I don't know, noblesse oblige and you've been given something and it's not yours, is to create a society that cares for itself in that way. That's my answer to that piece. I think you're asking an interesting question, which is, I'll frame it as a question because I don't know the answer. The question is, does the whole notion of the Ger Toshav, and I might even say the benevolence towards the Ger Toshav, depend on the Ger Toshav being kind of scattered vassals under the protection of the minority, of the majority, as opposed to a separate self-organized group with an individual identity? And that's a very good question. On some basic level, that's probably undoubtedly right. In other words, it's not the same to think about people who live in the country who do not have citizenship, who came in illegally and are vulnerable because they, you know, don't have X documentation, and they sort of hide in the shadows in all kinds of ways, basically qua individuals or very small groupings, as opposed to thinking about Native American tribes, as opposed to thinking about subunits of people who may begin to actually create whole sub-societies that might even speak other languages that have their own principles of organization that start to form, as you say, a third society or sort of another world within. Even there, I think there's probably a distinction between, does the majority view those groups as a mortal threat or, you know, a problem yet to be resolved of people who have not been integrated? And this, I think you see, right, it is obviously putting aside the question of land claims and historical claims and questions of political right and wrong. The question in Israel of a local Arab population as opposed to a local population of Thais is a totally different question, in part on the axis you're raising, right? Which is to say, foreign workers who live in South Tel Aviv, they may have some grouping, but they're basically a bunch of individuals who are occasionally going to come together to raise some noise about something, but for the most part, they can be completely isolated as individuals. I think one of the dreams over the years, like sometimes partially realized, not always, of Zionist policies towards Arabs in the land of Israel was, could you divide them into enough subgroups that you could cut deals with each one? And you wouldn't be dealing with a 40%, you know, mass of population. Because there's the Druze Ger Toshav population, as it were. And there's the Christian Ger Toshav population, etc. It's a great question. I think it goes to one of the other potential limits. And as I said at the right of this discourse, as I said at the beginning, this is not like, oh, here we go, we're going to look at this category, we're going to solve everything. The question is, does it help us think through what are the questions we have to be asking? It's a good question. Yeah?
I want to hear you play out a little bit more the kind of paternalism, benevolence dimension of this. I think you've mostly been talking about how, like, if there's too many Ger Toshav, then we, like, run into a problem that could become too terrible. But I think there's also this element of, a person can only ask you for a handout if you think that they're poor. And if they're not poor enough, you're not going to give them a handout. And also, if you're not wealthy enough, you're not going to give them a handout. And there's, I'm moving towards seeing that there's, a reason why you wouldn't allow them to be powerful is because you want them to be a protected group so that you can sort of exercise your kindness over them. I'm thinking particularly that this connects to the interest piece in like a very real way. Because yeah, not only does the bank not give you an interest-free loan, but Jews aren't really giving out that many interest-free loans either. Most of us are getting business dispensations, and most of us are writing principal so that we don't have to remit our loans.
That's right.
It seems like the only people that are benefiting from a system of interest without loopholes are the Ger Toshav and the non-Jews who are like, please, I want some Jewish moneylenders in my country so that like, I can start some businesses. I don't really have any like actual idea of where I'm going. But I want to talk a little bit about like how much of this is really for the benefit of the Ger Toshav, and we like want to be in a relationship where we're able to give to them, and how much of it is it really like we're threatened by them and we need to protect ourselves.
Yeah, so here's where I think it breaks down to the extent you're looking for a description of how are we trying to act politically with respect to X group. This is where I think the notion of this being more of a construct and not clear when it really applies and to whom in real time makes it very hard to answer that as like, here's our program for dealing with X, Y, and Z. I think the best we can get to is we can get to controlled kind of moments or scenarios where it feels like there's a very important value that rises to the surface. One of those important values, which we saw last time, is v'chai imach mitzvah l'achayoto. that there's some notion of like, this person is like dependent on you in some way. You have to help them, you've got to support them, and you've got to basically treat them as an equal with respect to that sort of baseline of economic and social responsibility. What we're looking at tonight, I think, again, I don't think it spells out a program. I'm trying to also point out the ways in which some of this we can imagine being upsetting and undermining l'hachayoto on some level if the discourse is too strong around some of these things, is that there are other times where, for sure descriptively, but I'm even saying, I think in some of these cases, even we would say prescriptively, yeah, what it's going to mean to be in the group or be out of the group is going to have consequences. Now, you know, this is just a following up, I think, you know, Eliana, the other thing that you're that relates to this, which I alluded to before, but I want to say it again. It's obviously a dramatically different question if there is a path to naturalization or not. Okay, right? That, I think, we always feel infinitely better about the group having even dramatic privileges over the outsiders if it feels like it's easy to become a member of the group. The second it's not, you get into something that's much more essentialist, and you might still do that, but you're going to have to ground it in other ways. It's going to have to be much more self-evident, like parent, child, etc. I don't have a better, fuller answer other than to say I would caution against trying to draw a story here of here's how we think we deal with it. I think the most we can do is get these snapshots of values, concerns, and motives, etc. Okay, let's look at this. This to me is a really interesting category. For the Responsa Radio fans among you, this was something we took up in one of our episodes. On page 6, and if you're not a Responsa Radio fan, you should be. On page 6, I want us to look at a really interesting other category here, which is not about policing the boundary from without per se, or kind of saying you're not fit. Well, let's leave that. It is partially saying that, but it's not about part. It's not about per se drawing a difference. I think there is a sense of being in the group puts you in a position of unique and distinctive responsibility to make certain things happen, which you will weaken if on some level you blur the boundary between who's in and who's out. All right, that sounds very abstract. Let's see what we're talking about here. First of all, Vayikra says, someone read this. Read it out for us. All right, Vayikra 22. Please, Anat.
The Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Speak to Aaron and his sons, and to all the Israelite people, and say to them, any man of the house of Israel or of the strangers in Israel presents a burnt offering as his offering for any of the votive or any of the freewill offerings that they offer to the Lord, it must, to be acceptable in your favor, be a male without blemish, from cattle or sheep or goats. You shall not offer any veteran of either, for it will not be accepted in your favor. And when a man offers from the herd or the flock a sacrifice of well-being to the Lord for an explicit vow or as a freewill offering, it must, to be acceptable, be without blemish. There must be no defect in it."
Okay, basic law, you bring a sacrifice, it cannot have a mum. It cannot have a defect. The animal has to be complete, healthy, undamaged. And now?
"Nor shall you accept such animals from a foreigner to offer in this food for your God. For they are mutilated, they have a defect, they shall not be accepted in your favor."
Okay, so what's the addition here? And that's true also if the offering comes from a Gentile. Okay? Now, what's the verse combating? You might have thought all of these rules about an animal being in perfect condition applies to Jews who have all kinds of, Israelites who have all kinds of cultic requirements at the temple of their God, etc. But if it's coming from someone from the outside, I mean, they can give whatever they want. Who cares? Answer is no. It has a blemish. It's unfit on the altar. I don't care who sent it. But what do we learn, by the by, from this verse? Gentiles can send sacrifices. That's taken for granted. Okay? The only thing is they got to live up to the same rules. And note, this is miyad ben nechar, Okay? This is not the ger who is in the first verse here. Of course the ger brings a sacrifice. In the biblical scheme, that actually meant the non-Israelite ger is in the sacrificial system. In the rabbinic rereading, the convert, of course, brings sacrifices like everyone else. But the chidush here, the real innovative point, is a Gentile, a nochri, a total outsider, can bring a sacrifice. All right? So we have some notion here of there can be participation in the temple in some way. All right? But we're going to drill down on exactly what that means. Nochrim can participate. Okay. Now we go to Ezra on page 6 and 7. We are now here in the moment of Shivat Zion. We are before, even though this is from Sefer Ezra, we're before Ezra comes on the scene. We're literally in the first generation that has come back via Cyrus's decree after the first temple being destroyed, coming back from Babylon to the land of Israel. And then we have this really amazing scene. The enemies of Yehuda and Binyamin, the only two tribes who are left, hear that the people returning from the exile are building a temple to Hashem, to Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh, the God of Israel. And they come and they approach Zerubbabel, who is basically in charge at the time, Kates Bavel, Zerubbabel, and the other heads of the community, and they say, Nivnei Machem. We want to join in. We want to be a part of this project. Ki Chachem Nidrosh Leloichem. We also want to seek out and pray to your God. Velo, Anachnu Zovchim Imei Esar Chadon Melech Ashur Amaleh Otanu Po. And in fact, we have been offering sacrifices to your God since we were brought here by the Assyrian king a couple hundred years ago. Meaning these are the people who will later be described in rabbinic literature as Kutim. These are the Samaritans. These are people who were, as part of the Assyrian displacement of the northern tribes, shipping in people from Babel, and they sort of half integrate into Israelite religion. They are there, and they say, we've been worshiping God. They've also been worshiping all kinds of other gods, the Bible tells us, but they've been worshiping Yud-Heh Vav-Heh among other gods. We want to build in. We're very happy to contribute to this effort of the temple. Vayomer lahem Zerubbabel v'Yeshua v'shar Rashei Avod l'Yisrael lo lachem v'lanu livnot bayit l'Eloheinu. This is not a job for you and for us. Ki anachnu, we, the in-group, yachad nivneh, we are going to build this together to the God of Israel, as Cyrus has told us. And then a really interesting postscript where, as a result of this, all the other people become hostile to this project, the people who wanted to join in, and they start to try to thwart it and write what is called, right, katvu sitna, al yoshvei Yehuda v'Yerushalayim, they actually turn against them, they wanted to be allies, they become thorns in their side. But this is a key moment where the community says, lo lachem valanu. No, it's not a joint endeavor. The responsibility for building this temple is ours. Now, there's a lot of ways to read this text on its own, okay? Let's look at Nehemiah, and we'll bundle that in also. Nehemiah is now we're now another later wave. Some kind of basic shrine has been built on Har HaBayit, but the city of Yerushalayim is still totally in disrepair. And here, Nehemiah says, then I said to them, you see the bad state we are in, Jerusalem lying in ruins and its gates destroyed by fire. Come, let us rebuild the wall of Jerusalem and suffer no more disgrace. I told them of my God's benevolent care for me, also of the things that the king had said to me. And they said, other members of the Judean community at the time, let's start building. They were encouraged by God's benevolence. When Sanballat the Chorani and Toviah HaAmoni and Geshem HaAravi heard this, they mocked us and held us in contempt and said, what is this that you are doing? Are you rebelling against the king? Why do we need to build up the walls? Only reason you build up walls is to defend against an invader. And these are people, each one with a non-Israelite, non-Jewish moniker attached to their name. Okay? But here, not offering help, mocking them. To which Nehemiah says in reply, the God of heaven will grant us success, and we, his servants, will start building. But you have no share or claim or stake in Jerusalem. Lachem ein chelek u'tzedakah v'zikaron b'Yerushalayim. Okay. Now, what do you make of these stories? You can basically read these stories in two ways. Right? One way you can read the story is that they are very local incidents with specific outsiders who wanted to join in the project, who were problematic, with no consequences for any later policy. Or you can read them as paradigmatic moments of keeping the Jews in and the Gentiles out vis-a-vis the project of the sanctuary. Okay? That's going to be the basic question of how to read Ezra and Nehemiah. Are they a template for saying, no, when you're talking about kind of building up basic Jewish institutions, because we do have the temple here, but also the walls of Jerusalem, which goes beyond the sacrificial piece, is that something that basically, yeah, there's some inner core there where it's got to be a Jew who is doing that. And lo lachem valanu becomes the kind of dividing law. Now, there do seem to have been both strands in rabbinic thinking, but one of them won out completely decisively. The question of any reading that wants to, right, on some level saying, oh, this was like a local thing, fits well with Vayikra's seemingly totally, complete acceptance of a Gentile bringing a sacrifice. And you could say, oh, I don't know, the Gentiles are allowed to show up and be a part of that worship of God. Might not be commanded to do all the things that Jews do, but if they want to be a part of it, no problem, okay? The school of Rabbi Ishmael seems to have preserved some notion of this. If you look in Sifrei B'Midbar, and this is uncovered in incredible like manuscript sleuth work by Menachem Kahana and his edition of Sifrei B'Midbar and uncovering manuscripts that read differently from the printed text. If you like that sort of thing, you can ask me afterwards. Here's what the Sifrei B'Midbar, according to the Vatican manuscript, says. There's a pasuk that says, Kol ha'ezrach ya'aseh kacha, that the every ezrach, every native born, has to follow such and such procedures around sacrifices. So what does the Sifrei say? What's the meaning of that? Well, because it is written, U'miyad ben-nechar lo takrivu et lechem Eloheihem mikol eile, from the hand of a Gentile, you cannot present as a sacrifice the bread of your God of all these blemished animals. These you do not accept from Gentiles, but you do accept the continual offerings. Eile iyata mekabel mehem, aval ata mekabel mehen timidin. Okay, this is a reading that says, when Vayikra says you're not allowed to accept a blemished animal from a Gentile, it means the only kind of sacrifice you can't accept from a Gentile is a blemished one. But you are allowed to have them contribute even to the tamid. You're allowed to have them contribute to the funds. This is like the half shekel that's collected from the entire population. They are allowed to pay into the coffers of public funds that pay for the daily lamb in the morning and the daily lamb in the afternoon. They're not required to, but they can. They can voluntarily join in and be a part of that process. That's the reading of Rabbi Ishmael. And then they go through the rest of the text, which I'm not going to take us through, of explaining that, okay, but that doesn't take you to saying that they bring libations and their sacrifices are the same. But the school of Rabbi Ishmael here in Sifrei B'Midbar preserve some notion, basically, that like if a Gentile shows up and says, I would like to be involved in the contributing to the core functioning of the Beit HaMikdash, I can't do the sacrifices. They're not a Kohen. They're not a priest. But they can contribute monetarily to that core bit, even though that's an obligation on the Jewish community. All right? That gets completely crushed by the school of Rabbi Akiva, which has a totally different reading. So here we're now on the bottom of 8. Going into 9. Someone volunteer to read me this Sifra and watch what happens here to Vayikra, and then we're going to see how we marshal Ezra and Nehemiah to our cause as well. Someone want to take this? Please. Nice and loud.
Israel, as stated, ger, the converts. The ger to include the wives of the converts. In Israel, to include women and slaves.
All right, we're back in the verse in Vayikra if you want to just check back, that began, that said, in laying out the rules around blemishes, said, Ish, ish mi beit Yisrael umin hager bi Yisrael. Every person, literally, a man, ish, ish, right? But idiomatically, each person from the house of Israel and from the ger who brings such and such, such and such, it can't be with a blemish. Okay, so we have derived from that. Yisrael means Jews, ger, converts, hager includes everything in the ger's household, not just the male convert, but the woman he is married to. Be Yisrael, nashim v'avadim, women and slaves. We have a patriarchal text here. People who are outside and connected to it, they're being read into that full formulation. But we haven't accounted for ish ish. What does that add? Okay, go ahead.
If so, what does ish ish include? Gentiles who vow votive offerings and gift offerings as a Jew does, which they will be present to the Lord as a burnt offering. This tells me only of a burnt offering. Whence do I include peace offerings? From their vows. Whence do I include thanks offerings? From their free will offerings. Whence do I include bird offerings, meal offerings, wine, frankincense, and wood? From all of their vows. Of all their free will offerings.
L'chol nidrehem, l'chol nidvotam. Okay.
This is according to Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Yossi Haglili said to him, even if you sit there including things all day, the only thing discussed here is the burden.
Okay, this is Rabbi Yossi Haglili taking a poke at Rabbi Akiva's hermeneutic, which he thinks is sort of irresponsible and going over the top. What's the major thrust of Rabbi Akiva? Rabbi Akiva is trying to actually add on to the kinds of things that a Gentile can donate to the Beit HaMikdash, to the temple. So far, this sounds very similar to Rabbi Akiva, to Rabbi Ishmael, what we saw earlier. Yes, the Gentile can send a gift of a burnt offering, can bring a nidava, can bring a donation, can have make a vow and bring it, can bring a shlamim, all these different things. They want to donate wood. They can donate all those things to the temple. No problem. Okay, but what's the one thing that's not on that list, most notably? The tamid. The continual offering. Read us just the Sifra now, a couple passages later.
How do we know that one does not accept shkalim, collected money used to fund the core temple operations, from a Gentile? Scripture teaches, and from the hand of a Gentile you shall not present the bread of your God from all thee.
Okay, amazing rereading of that verse. The plain sense of the verse was, Miyad b'nechar lo takrivu et lechem Eloheichem mikol eile. Don't present, a Gentile should not be allowed to present a blemished animal, mikol eile. But now we're reading it as, Umiyad b'nechar, and from a Gentile, lo takrivu et lechem Eloheichem. Do not offer up the bread of your God from the hand of a Gentile. That has to come from a Jew. And what is the bread of a Gentile? This tells me only of continual offerings, which are called bread, as it is written, et korbani lachmi le'ishai, my offerings, my bread for my fires. How do I know that that's true for all other korbanot tzibur, all other communal offerings? Mikol eile, from all these. Rabbi Akiva's drasha takes the verse in Vayikra out of the context of blemishes, and instead says, Lechem Elokechem. Wait a minute, what does that phrase mean? That means anything, basically, that, I'll put it in anthropomorphic terms, that God is counting on eating. That is God's regular menu. A Gentile can bring an hors d'oeuvre or dessert, but not the lechem, not the thing that is required. Which means you cannot accept funds from a Gentile to support the Korban Tamid twice a day, the various things that are brought on the holidays, and anything that basically is a communal responsibility. A Gentile themselves wants to bring something that they're moved to, which is added on to that, no problem. But there is some notion of the Jewish obligation to sustain the core function of the temple that cannot be farmed out to outsiders, even if they voluntarily want to be a part of it. This you see, I think, in the most striking way in the Mishnah in Shkalim. Afal pi she'amru, even though they said, Ein memashkenim nashim v'avadim uktanim, you do not go around and forcibly collect funds from women, slaves, and minors. This parenthetically is one of the best texts for showing that oftentimes the word nashim in rabbinic texts is not a biological term, but it is a sociological economic term. These are people who do not have independent means, who cannot be assumed as women, slaves, and minors to be the tax base to be collected from. Okay? So you don't go around and force them to contribute a half shekel if they haven't given it. But if they, of their own volition, want to contribute a half shekel, you accept it. And to accept a half shekel, so we understand, is to put it into the main coffers that will be used to pay for all the public sacrifices. Okay? So this is actually a way of underscoring these people are socioeconomically positioned such that we're not going to collect from them. They're not obligated. But they are part of the in-group. They are b'nei brit. They are part of this group such that if they contribute, that's fine. Nochri v'kuti, however, a foreigner or even a Samaritan, this will be important in a minute, sheshaklu, ein mekablim miyadam. If they say, hey, I'd like to give a half shekel, you can't accept that from them. What you don't accept from them, kinei zavin, kinei zavot, it goes through a whole thing of other things you can't accept from them. Zeaklal, here's the rule. Because this view still has to deal with the fact that Vayikra said you can bring, the Gentile can bring things. So what can the Gentile bring? Kol shehu nidar v'nidav mekablim miyadam v'chol she'eino lo nidar v'lo nidav ein mekablim miyadam. If it is voluntary, an add-on, you can accept it from them. But if it's not something that could be donated, I can't voluntarily bring the olat tamid, the continual offering in the morning. That just has to happen, okay? It's like, right, it's like the congregational kiddush as opposed to hot kiddush, okay? Right? Like the kiddush cookies, I'm gonna say, play it out in ridiculous form. Gentiles can't pay for the horrible kiddush cookies with jelly stuck in between them, but they can say, I'm sponsoring a challenge this week, okay? All right? There's some version of that notion that in terms of the core, I said it was a trivial example. There's a notion of the core operation here that has to play out, but external stuff can be brought, and what's the proof? V'cheinu miforash al yedei Ezra, lo lachem valanu livnot bayit leloheinu. That now becomes a paradigm. When Zerubbabel and Yeshua responded to the people, we can't accept that from you, that was a model of them taking responsibility as Jews and Israelites for their core function. I'm saying, I'm sorry, I actually cannot accept your help for this. And it wasn't just because there was tension between them in the sort of local political moment. That, according to this approach, which seems to be the school of Rabbi Akiva as filtered through the Mishnah, becomes the model for thinking about sort of monitoring that interaction. And you see this played out, the Rambam codifies this, that becomes the dominant position. And that is sort of the last boundary piece I will leave you with tonight, which I think is another interesting way of thinking about when even, sorry, what's relevant about the Rambam, you can see, is, and he tacks on, and this is true even for a ger toshav. Because the other thing is, even with Rabbi Akiva, you could imagine, maybe I'm not accepting it from that person because they're an idolater. Or they're not a decent person. And the Rambam says, no, I want you to understand what's going on here. This isn't about that person is not okay or you don't approve of them. This is about they're not Yisrael. They're not in the group. There are certain things that the group basically has as a responsibility and obligation for itself that might be bound up on some level with some privilege or pomp and circumstance, but the fundamental lens through which we think of it is, this is my responsibility. Yes, you can participate in other ways, but you're not going to be able to actually participate in this core way, right? And this is the thing too I think is interesting, where it's not just about the group, but what is the nature of the activity. Here it's pretty clear, like the temple and the walls of Jerusalem are understood to be a kind of core in-group Jewish responsibility. You can imagine a different reading that drew that line more broadly or narrowly. I'm suggesting to you there is generally going to be some line of that sort. This is, I think, a really interesting thing also to think about in terms of voting. Voting is obviously a privilege, but it also doubles to be some degree of responsibility. Who do you give that to? I have heard that in New Zealand, if you are present on the day of the election, you vote. Okay? In other words, it's almost a biblical notion of land and presence. Like, if you're here, you're affected by what we decide. So you vote. Probably helps how many people go to New Zealand, okay? But, and how many nuclear weapons does New Zealand have, et cetera, et cetera. But, right, there's a notion of they're defining the group as, you know, who is here, who is present. Obviously, most other societies will say, no, you're not a citizen. That already means you don't have the franchise. And the franchise is always some combination of a privilege and a right to express yourself, but also some kind of mirror of who's taking responsibility for this society? Who needs to own this? And while donations and a desire to participate are one thing and may even often be welcome, there's going to be spaces where people will feel like, no, this is actually not a space for a donation. This is a space for people who are expected to stand up and be counted to be a piece of that. And there's a lot of other institutions, I think, beyond the citizenship piece that often play in that way. It's how a lot of people think about the concept of what it is to count in a minyan. It's not just a privilege of being a part of something. It is a reflection of some degree of obligation and responsibility that you have. It is also true around things like witnessing. The right to be a witness is also intimately bound up with my ability to subpoena you to be a witness. And there are a lot of things where when we think about privileges, I think we have to ask ourselves, what responsibilities are they paired with? I'm going to leave there so we don't go much later than I already did. Next time, come back, bring your friends. We're going to tie it all up, and it's all going to make perfect sense. Thank you.